You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, June 17th, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Cara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Good evening.
So the world continues to simmer along with all of the things.
Just barely.
Yeah, that are happening.
A week-to-week assessment, yeah.
Yeah, we've been doing the COVID-19 updates because, like, we're in the middle of a pandemic, but then the Black Lives Matter issue has exploded for, you know, good reason. And that deserves a lot of attention as well. We've actually been getting a lot of questions about some of the science and critical thinking issues surrounding the protests that are happening and statistics, et cetera, and studies that have been coming out. So we're going to address those in the email and questions section because, you know, I think that's a good way to deal with those issues by answering questions and being a little bit more interactive.
And since that happens to be in our sweet spot, we might as well dig in.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, we definitely, so yeah, and we've been talking about, like, what should we be talking about when all this big, big world-changing stuff is happening around us. We can't just talk about narrow news stories. But yeah, we want to do what we do best, right? We want to contribute, you know, what we feel is in our sweet spot, as you say, Jay, which is let's talk about the science, the evidence, the critical thinking, and maybe hopefully raise the level of discourse a little bit if we can do that. So the quick COVID-19 update, again, it seems like it's accelerating. Like there's just so much news, so many news items with it. One thing that's interesting that I wrote about earlier in the week is that, and we've had a number of these questions, what was the effect of the lockdown on the flu season?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Right, great question.
Help, right?
Yeah, 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 absolutely.
And now we have some data. So, of course, it depends on where you are in the world. The COVID-19 hit the U.S. at the tail end of the flu season. This flu season was a particularly bad one. It was at the upper end of the typical range.
Was there an issue with the vaccinations or
no?
They just
no,
weren't as
there
effective?
Wasn't. No, the vaccine was actually fine this year. It wasn't the vaccine. It was just a bad flu season.
Interesting.
Yeah, there was between 20,000 and 60,000 deaths in the U.S., which, mm-hmm. you know, the
well, which was it? 20 or 60? I mean, that's a huge range, man.
That's a wide number. Yeah.
290 to 650 globally. So the reason for the range is because...
Did it kill the person or not?
No. Most people who get the flu don't get a flu test. And so then you have to infer...
That's right.
So clinically, did they have the flu? So if you count just laboratory-confirmed cases, that's at the low end. And if you count probable clinical cases, that's at the high end. So
I don't think I've ever had a flu test.
Yeah,
I've had I get a vaccine every year, but I don't think I've ever gone to the doctor and them actually test me for the flu. They just say... Oh, you probably have the flu.
Exactly.
So the high number is the extrapolation of what was likely...
Yeah, so
based upon presentation.
Yeah, like if you go to your doctor and say I have the flu and they treat you for the flu, that counts. Even though they didn't do a laboratory test to confirm it was actually the influenza virus.
Right.
I don't think they should even state the low end then. I mean, because it's clearly wrong. Clearly.
Yeah.
Well, whatever.
It has to be a floor. They want you to know it wasn't zero.
Yeah. We're basically just showing the error bars. Yeah. This is
a sideshow, guys. Let me get to what we're actually talking about. So you're right.
Sometimes a sideshow is really fascinating.
So if you graph out the numbers of infected, of hospitalizations, and of deaths, you know, it typically peaks January, February, and then trails off through May. Mm-hmm. But this year, basically, it ended 5 weeks early. Like lockdown completely shut down the flu season.
Cut it off at the knees.
But yeah. Steve, you know, I don't want to sound like a jerk right now, but no shit.
Yeah, exactly.
Jay, but it's not. It isn't no shit because think about it. You know, people are questioning whether or not the lockdown was effective. And this is an independent piece of evidence that, yeah, it's effective. It actually does keep viruses from spreading around, not just COVID-19, but also the flu season. As you said, you know, it should have worked, but it's nice to know that it actually did.
Yeah.
And Jay, don't forget, a lot of people were saying, you know, well, you know, if this coronavirus is so bad, why don't we take similar measures with bad flu seasons. And a lot of people were thinking, like, yeah, maybe we should take it more seriously, because that's a lot of people that die every year. And here's more proof then that if we did take it a little bit more seriously, especially in a bad flu season, and do something akin, you know, not a full on lockdown, but just being more careful with touching your face and maybe even more masks, we can cut those numbers down as well for the annual flu.
Exactly.
Yeah, Bob. Wouldn't it be great if, like, the human behavior change, the biggest thing that came out of this, is that people actually follow their own advice and decide not to go to work when they're feeling sick?
Yeah.
Or not send their kids to school when they're feeling sick.
I think handshakes are done.
Yeah, I think so too.
Or if not severely curtailed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there are behaviors that are going to change probably forever as a result of this.
I think so, and I hope in a good way. So, Bob, I think you're absolutely right, and think about it. If 60,000 people died this flu season in the U.S. from the flu, or 400,000 died, you know, worldwide, it wouldn't have made headlines. There would have been zero discussion about it, because we've become complacent, because it happens every year. And, you know, this is not to say that we needed to respond this way to COVID-19, because if we hadn't, there would have been hundreds of thousands
more of
more deaths in the U.S. and millions of deaths in the world. So it would have been much, much worse. But at the other end, I do think it absolutely means maybe we shouldn't be so complacent about the flu. Mm-hmm. And maybe we could take some of the skills that we're learning collectively, you know, as a society, and apply that to the flu season. So if people were, as you say, Kara, if you're sick, don't go to work. Don't send your kid to work. Wear masks. If you're going to be in tightly public places during flu season, wear a mask. Wash your hands. Don't touch your face.
Don't fly sick.
Don't fly. Exactly. You know, and maybe we need to think carefully about how we just arrange our big social events so that we're not creating petri dishes all over the place. Mm-hmm. And maybe coming out of this, we will be better able to treat those flu seasons, because we have people are more ready to do it, because they've just mostly been ignoring the CDC every year when it comes to, you know, flattening the curve of the flu. The one other little thing is that when we're counting, you know, we're trying to calculate the risk versus benefit of the economic shutdown, there's a lot of things other than COVID-19 deaths that we have to consider on both ends of the equation. But at the very least, we have to count tens of thousands of people saved from dying of the flu. That counts as well.
Oh, mm-hmm. You're right. Like, that's an economic benefit.
Yeah. Totally.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't think a lot of people think about that.
But there's things on both sides. So the economic shutdown is not benign either. So clearly we can't do this every year. And that was one thing. I think, how often can we do this? Probably, like, it might be 20 years before we could really weather another shutdown like this.
Gosh, which sucks, because I doubt it'll be 20 years before another pandemic.
That means we need sustainable strategies for mitigating epidemics and pandemics. So that we don't ever have to shut down our economy like this again.
And they need to be organized. You know, there's a great, this is like, I sound like a broken record. The newest Frontline, which just came out like yesterday or the day before on PBS, is, I think it's called something like Coronavirus, What Went Wrong? Mm-hmm. And it's all about countries that handled it well, countries that didn't, the missteps that we made with the CDC, the missteps, which missteps are with the WHO. It's actually really well done. They researched a lot of, like, what did we F up this time so we could do better next time?
If we don't learn from these mistakes, we are just doing ourselves the greatest disservice in humanity.
You see South Korea doing so well because they dealt with SARS and then MERS. And they just had, they were like, we ain't going to let this happen again.
Yeah.
And they were, I mean, they just had this amazingly rapid response. And, like, we could do that too. I think you're so right, Steve, that we've been complacent. I also wonder if some of the behavioral, like the psychological drive behind these behavioral issues, is that the people who are most affected are also the people who are kind of most hidden in society. So like the elderly who are often living in nursing homes or don't go out in public as often, people who are low SES, you know, who are struggling, they're sort of not as elevated or visible in society. And so I think it's easy to just get complacent and forget about it being a problem. Because if you ask most kind of middle to upper middle class people in America, like, hey, isn't the flu dangerous? They're like, the flu doesn't kill people.
Yeah, it's true.
They're like, I've never met anybody who the flu has killed. And it's like, well, you're lucky then.
It's probably not true also.
Yeah, probably not.
Here are the numbers. So about 8.4 million cases worldwide, 450,000 deaths, over 115,000 deaths in the U.S. So still, we're sort of overall in the U.S., the numbers are starting to come down, but it's very state by state. And here's the thing. We're starting to get, you know, again, it's not clear if people should call this like a surge, a second wave, a resurgence or whatever. But there are a number of states that are really peaking now. Arizona, Arkansas, South Carolina, Alabama, Oregon, Florida are all having these peaks. I think Arizona is the worst right now.
Interesting.
And
yeah, mostly the southern.
And it relates to their behavior. It relates to the regulations in those states. I mean, it's pretty clear.
They opened up faster and like more vigorously.
Yeah.
I think we're at a point now where our infection rate is just exceeding all of Western Europe combined.
Yeah, I mean, we're still very much in the middle of the first wave of this pandemic, you know. Overall sense that it's over. And they're trying to go back to business as usual. But no, you look at the numbers. I mean, it's still, we're in the middle of this still.
Well, and that's what shows, we kind of discussed this a little on Friday, but it just goes to show a basic misunderstanding about like the mechanics of a virus. Like we're nowhere near herd immunity. We don't have a really good treatment yet, although there is that steroid that people have been talking about that seems to be showing promise. We don't have a vaccine. What reason do we think that we are now more protected than we were before? We're just not.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
No, I mean, complacency and laziness.
What's basically changed is that the places where the virus was smacking hard has lessened significantly, and now it's just moved to other states.
It's still in those places. That's the thing. The places where the virus smacked really hard got their shit together and shut down more severely.
Mm, yep.
And the places that never shut down or that did shut down but goes, hey, I don't see a problem. Nothing ever happened here because you were shut down. Just loosened everything up and now they're getting hit hard. The virus is everywhere.
Yeah.
It's not going away until we can vaccinate against it or until enough people get it that we're not going to catch it again.
Yeah. And that's the final thing. I do hope that in addition to like wearing masks being more socially acceptable, even required, going forward during flu season or whatever. Hopefully support for things like vaccines will be much higher. To see the compliance rate could be much higher with the flu vaccine. Maybe if and when we do develop a COVID-19 vaccine, I wonder if they can, pair it with the flu vaccine. And if they were given at the same time, would the compliance with the flu vaccine go up?
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
But it's also interesting how many people are already writing about and doing studies about, there's like already vaccine resistance to the non-existent COVID vaccine.
Right.
Steve, in the news recently, they're talking about steroids helping reduce the...
Kara brought that up. So
that's a new one,
dexamethasone, which is a powerful intravenous steroid. There was a study which showed that it might decrease the death rate in the sickest people, right? So essentially some infections, during parts of the infection, it's the inflammatory response that does the damage. And so especially with viruses. Mm. So the question is, like with some bacteria, like it releases toxins, like the infection itself is doing all the harm. With viral infections, often it's the body's immune inflammatory response that actually does the harm. It's the inflammation. And so the question
is, people refer to cytokine storms.
Well, yeah, that's part of it.
What's happening.
Yeah, that's part of it. It's like the cytokine storm is like at the end at the sickest patients when things just shut down. But if you give steroids to shut down the inflammation, what will happen? It will sort of reduce the damage from the inflammation, but it also lets the infection go unchecked. And so there's a balancing act there. And so you have to study it with every virus, every type of infection. and maybe even different phases of the infection. You know, like there's some types of meningitis, for example, where steroids are helpful. Other types of meningitis where steroids will kill you. You know, it totally depends on on the specific infection. But it was reasonable to study it in COVID-19 because when people are really sick, the virus and the inflammation are just ravaging their organs, especially their lungs. So it was a reasonable idea. So saying, okay, if we use steroids when, you know, basically the game is otherwise over, you know, like the inflammation is just destroying their organs, can this save some people? And it apparently, you know, the preliminary evidence is positive, but of course we need to study it a little bit more carefully.
That's good news for like the sickest people. You know, it's good to hear, because the scary part of this virus is what it does to people when they're, you know, already on the ventilator. By the time they get there, like, it doesn't look good.
Yeah, it's incremental. It's, you know, it's not a game changer, but I think that overall doctors are just getting incrementally better at treating COVID-19. I think that's probably a big reason why like the death rate is going down faster than the infection rate is. I think we're just getting better at jumping on people who are sick, testing them, treating them, you know.
Yeah, and probably people are getting treated earlier too.
Yeah.
So the bottom line is, we are still within the pandemic. You know, tell your friends and family and everyone that you can, you know, be mindful. Don't let your guard down. We got to keep, you know, keep the protocols high and active. That's it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
We need endurance at this point and discipline. Otherwise, you know, we may look back at this and think, God, this again was an opportunity where we let it get away from us, and then we're going to be paying for it down the road. All right, we'll muddle along. Jay, you're going to start the news item segment by telling us about this new brain on a chip.
So engineers at MIT have designed a brain on a chip that is actually smaller than a piece of confetti.
All right, you have to define brain for us, Jay. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, here we go. So, you know, it's kind of like a brain. So it's made up of tens of thousands of silicon-based brain synapses known as memristors. Memristors.
What?
That's a portmanteau.
Resistor, but memory?
Memory transistors.
Memristor is a portmanteau of memory and resistor.
Ah, I was right. It's resistor, not transistor.
Oh, I'm sorry. And resistor. You're right, Bob. So the engineers published the results of their research in the journal Nature Nanotechnology. And I just like the fact that we're at an age where we have journals that are named with the word nanotechnology in them, and it's legit.
Yeah, well, Nature Phrenology kind of closed a while ago. So.
Yeah, they've been out for a while, man.
Keep in mind that there have been many advances in this exact area, right? And this is just another incremental advancement that was made with memristors out of alloys of silver, copper, and silicon. Now, previous versions were made with unalloyed elements and didn't function as well as the new one. And that is basically it at its core. But let me give you some of the details, because there's some cool stuff that they're doing here. So memristors are called neuromorphic devices, which means they mimic the human brain's neural architecture. Neuromorphic. I love that. A neuromorph. That could have been one of our patrons' names, right?
Right.
Bob? These connections are an essential component in neuromorphic computing. So even though it serves as a transistor in a circuit, it's actually a lot more like a real human brain synapse. It's the connection between two neurons, right? That's really what this memory transistor is doing. It's in a traditional transistor, you either have on or off. And when we think about what does an actual synapse do, a synapse isn't on or off. A synapse has to do with like the amplitude or the volume of the signal that's coming through. And they were
but it becomes all or nothing. That's how neurons
in a way
work. Yeah, there's like a threshold. There's a cutoff.
There's a threshold effect, and the neuron either fires or not. But what really makes a difference is the frequency at which the neuron fires. Is it firing fast or slow? And that's
true.
Analog. So yeah, each individual firing is all or nothing, but the rate at which it fires is that's the variable. And that's something a lot of people don't know. They think, oh, the signal goes through, the neuron just fires once. Like, it's a train of firing. And so in that way the signal's analog. Right. And so this is a way that's the memristor is a way of doing the same thing, where it's not just on or off. It's not a one or a zero. It's a range in between.
A memristor could send a varying strength of signal depending on the strength of the signal received, right? Because it kind of just repeats the signal that it's got.
Yeah, so that is really similar, actually. Yeah.
So this makes it function much more like a real synapse. And if you think of that like the difference between on or off, which essentially is two options, a memristor would have many, many more options, making its possible range of operations much bigger. So another interesting thing is that a memristor would be able to remember a value that was associated with a particular signal strength and recreate the same exact signal the next time it receives that specific signal. And that's where this thing dives into super complexity, because when you have it's able to have memory, right? Which I'm sure physically it's got memory. But I guess what they're saying is when it gets the same strength of signal, it'll access the memory that it had. Kind of replicating what's going on in the brain in a way.
At the synaptic level, it's replicating it.
Yeah. So previous memristors designs, they didn't use alloys, like I said before, and they had a problem with ions that would flow through them actually wandering off track and getting kind of lost, right? So it's kind of like, think about a hose that has water going through it, and there's a little dribble of a hole that's letting water out, and some of the water gets lost. Well, that water is crucial. Why?
What's funny, because that happens all the freaking time in the brain or in body cells.
Yeah.
But that's exactly how cells work.
So the accuracy is there. It's consistent because when, like the hose, when water leaks out, then the amount of water going from point A to point B is not the correct amount, which isn't soliciting the correct response or reaction by everything else around it, right? It's a little complicated, but...
The funny thing is, like, I'll be impressed when it still works, even though it's leaky as hell, which is how our brains are.
Well, let's get as close to perfection as we can first, and then we'll let it get freaked. So, they're calling it signal strength. So when some of these ions get lost, the signal strength drops. And then that was a problem because things weren't predictable and weren't acting in a way that they wanted. So the engineers looked to known metallurgy techniques to solve the problem, which was genius if you think about it. So they figured out that copper was the right metal to add to the silver and silicon mixture. So
now that's right, copper.
That's right, copper. because they knew from metallurgy techniques, they knew that copper would help retain the ions inside the flow. And it worked. So the researchers said that in performance tests, the new hardware worked better than its predecessors, and they were able to do a lot of really cool things with them working much better. They were using it to sharpen an out of focus image, which I thought was really cool. This is not truly novel because software programmers have already created artificial synapse networks with software, right? But that is just not the same. And the research team wants to build a physical neural network it's hardware based. And so this could be used when they really get this slick as a portable artificial intelligence system. Now, don't think it's not going to be conscious. Like, let me explain what this means. This would come in handy for an example, if you would want to operate without an internet connection. So like today, you're talking to your phone and it tells you, it types out what you said, right? Your phone can't do that. Your phone is sending what you're saying to their server farm with really amazing software on the other end that's translating what you're saying and sending back the translation, right? It's not happening on the phone.
I didn't say they could do that.
Yes, you did when you checked that box.
Oh, shit.
So this is considered.
I didn't read all that. Yeah,
this is considered heavy processing. That why would you want everybody's phone to have to even come? They couldn't. Your phone couldn't handle the amount of processing that needs to be done to do this. So, and it's very smart from a software perspective to have all the phones, be sending back to the main server. The main server has all the juice to do the processing, and then it just gives you back the answer. That's fine, but there are circumstances where you want things to happen super fast and you don't want to be relying on the internet. Like for smart cars, as an example, you want cameras on a smart car to be able to see something and get an instantaneous, a millisecond response, which you can't get fast enough over the internet. Then you have to do it locally. And this would be the way that they would be able to take that super dense and process heavy computations locally and shrink them down so we can have them in a computer that's in your car or your cell phone or, you know, handheld devices at some point. So they're calling it having a resident neural network. And they're saying that it would be independent from the internet. It would operate in real time as opposed to having to wait to get the response back from some server somewhere. You know, if the internet goes down and the space shuttle or whatever and the Dragon capsule is using this, they're screwed. You know what I mean? So you have the intelligence on board. So it's an incremental move. It's, you know, it's really cool because they were able to make a milestone change here, even though it didn't lurch things forward so much that we should be like, hey, 5 to 10. Nobody's saying 5 to 10 on this. But I find it interesting because as we mimic, you know, the human brain, you know, as we kind of reverse engineer what the brain is doing and we're pulling more and more pieces out, that they're going to try to fit into this hardware. You know, what are we going to get? And will there be, I put it to all of you guys, will there be some type of emergent consciousness? Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
So the next news item, which I'm going to cover, is also about kind of a narrow technical thing. But I thought this was just too cool not to mention. Have any of you heard the word Twistronics?
Not yet.
No, not
Twistronics.
No. I think I did.
Sounds like a video game.
Yeah, so it's like this entirely new technology, which could come
entirely new.
Could come to nothing, could transform our technological world.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you know, one or the other.
Yeah, so okay.
I'll take four of them.
This is going to be quick. This is what it is in a nutshell. You take a two-dimensional material.
That is cool, Steve. I mean, who would think of that?
Two-dimensional material, okay.
Like...
Yeah, paper.
Like
paper?
Graphene, right? Graphene.
Sure, graphene.
The graphene is made, it's paper? A two-dimensional, you know, two-dimensional material made of carbon where you have a chicken wire, you know, hexagonal configuration, right?
I love it. Like a hex map, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And this has, you know, we've been talking for years about the fact that these two-dimensional materials and these graphene materials have really interesting properties in terms of their conduction of electricity, their conduction of heat, their strength, their lightweight. You could make nanofibers out of them, nanotubes, you know, all kinds of things. You can dope them with other material to alter their properties.
Ooh,
and this has been a
them.
Very, very active in material science research over the last decade. And we're starting to see applications at the basic end, like mixing little nanofiber, you know, these carbon nanofibers into material so that it's stronger, for example. But, you know, we've had a hard time manufacturing it at a massive industrial scale, especially with at the level of quality that we need, because even one kink or rip or whatever could really destroy the physical properties, right? They could unzip. All right. But anyway, so researchers have been researching what happens when you take two sheets of graphene, right, and then you rotate them or twist them slightly relative to each other.
So they touch each other in certain places? Is that what you're saying?
No, it's more that you lay them directly on top of each other, but then one is rotated with respect to the other. So they're not...
Oh, so there's almost like a crosshatch pattern.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, you double, cool. Triple, quadruple the strength or something?
So theorists predicted that there might be a magic angle that when you...
Oh.
And that at that magic angle, really new physics, you know, may happen. It's kind of like a metamaterial, right, Bob?
Wow. Yay, new physics, yes.
Yeah.
Got his attention.
And then in 2018, experimental physicists demonstrated that the magic angle actually exists. It's 1.1 degrees, so it's very, very small angle.
Whoa.
So if you take two sheets of graphene and you rotate them with respect to each other by 1.1 degrees, then it becomes, what do you guess?
10 times?
Becomes 10 times
a superconductor.
Oh, no way.
Whoa, wait.
A legit superconductor?
A legit superconductor.
What temperature, though?
One of the holy grails of
what temperature?
Material science.
Still super cold?
It's a superconductor up to 1.7 Kelvin.
Up to 1.7 Kelvin.
That's
cold. So kind of hovering very close to absolute zero.
Yeah, but it's more about the proof of concept.
Yes. Yeah. Who knows? They may be able to tweak that, but just learning that such a simple thing can create a superconductor.
Yeah, yeah.
Can explode our knowledge on superconductors in general.
So it's tunable. Basically, the resistance is tunable by twisting the layers. In the recent study that was done, though, it extended this one notch. They looked at the graphene, but they included in it molybdenum trioxide.
Molybdenum.
Or moly trioxide. And with this two-dimensional material, they were able to make it a superconductor of light. Oh. But not only that.
Wait, what does that mean?
So, okay, I don't know. This is what it means. So normally light would basically propagate in every direction, would diffract quite a bit. And mm-hmm. what they found at the magic angle, light traveled in straight lines without diffracting. They would propagate, you know, just in a single direction. So why would that be important? That would be important because this could potentially be useful for photonics. Yeah, so for basically using electrical devices, you know, like electronic devices, but with light instead of electrons.
Oh, right. Therefore, everything's fiber optic at that point.
No, not fiber optic. This is not just for information. This is photonics. This is like your computer
running on photons
running
instead of
on
electrons.
Running on photons instead of electrons. Exactly.
That's what I said. So, the actual. Whoa. Okay, that's awesome. Think beyond the connection.
It's photonic versus electronic, right? You think about it that
cool.
way.
Cool. Is anything photonic right now?
So
I think so.
I don't know if there's any actual application. It's more of a research thing, but
right.
because it's again, we're trying to find materials that will allow us to control light with enough precision cool. in order to make a device out of it. So this is again along those lines.
What's the byproduct?
Efficiency and speed, I think, because imagine this.
Yes.
Not only is it operating at the speed of light. Right, and that's because the photons don't interact. They go right through each other, whereas electrons do. So you could be crossing the streams as much as you want, and you're not going to get any of the interference that you would get with electrons. So that's huge.
Right. So a theoretical photonic device would be faster, smaller, and cooler, you know, than an equivalent electronic device.
And you mean
device.
Temperature cooler, not just like cooler.
Temperature cooler.
Yeah,
produce
both
less,
and
less, which is important. Cool. It's important if you're trying to implant a device in your brain, for example. You know, you don't want it to produce any waste heat. And the smaller and faster is also important as well. So implantable devices might be one of the target, you know, applications for a photonic computational device, for example. So that's basically it. This is an incremental advance. It's a proof of concept thing. It's just opening up this new world of tuning the physical properties of these two-dimensional materials simply by manipulating the twisted angle of one layer on top of another. And there are these magic angles where new physics happens. And again, this is just, we're at the very, very beginning of this. Again, in 30 years, this will be a laboratory curiosity or it will transform our technology. It's hard to say.
Yeah. Now, Steve, do you consider this a metamaterial?
It is considered a metamaterial.
Okay, it makes sense. Yeah.
So
makes
does
sense.
It lose its 2D definition if it twists, when it becomes twisted?
No.
When you start layering these things? It's still considered 2D?
Yeah, it's still considered 2D.
Still flatter than paper.
Yeah. So Bob, what do you think is
4-for-1.
The important force at work at that scale between the two twisted two-dimensional layers?
Van der Waals.
Very good. Excellent.
Oh, yeah, baby.
That is it. That's the same force. It's because
Gecko.
Gecko. Like it's a very close-up force, like between surfaces or between particles, etc. It also deals with a polariton. Bob, you know what a polariton is?
I have heard of them. Yes, I have.
It's a quasi-particle.
Kind of like a hole almost, right? Quasi-particles?
Quasi-particles are not real particles. They're just phenomena that behave like particles.
Right.
Because like they could move and track or whatever. But so it's a quasi-particle that emerges when you excite a photon. So they're also important. You know, the polaritons, I think, are what are being propagated in the single direction through the twisted two-dimensional material. And it's anisotropic, which I believe was one of our words. Wasn't it, Kara? Ooh. Anisotropic? Just means that it has different properties in different directions or different configurations.
Yeah. Yes, it was. We talked about the ion amount.
As opposed to isotropic, where it's the same in every direction. Right.
Sounds like you're just making a lot of this up, but
yeah, I mean,
it's science.
I'm backing him up. It's not bullshit.
Yeah. It's like there is that line for a kind of like the naive listener who's like, is this sci-fi? It's almost sci-fi.
Oh, you want sci-fi? Here's the actual article. Okay, listen to this. Following our previous discovery published in 2018, we found that biaxial van der Waals semiconductors, like, you know, the chemicals used, represent an emerging family of material supporting exotic polaritonic behaviors.
Kara, listen to me very carefully.
Listening.
The Emperor made everything that happened to Anakin Skywalker happen to him. He funneled him into becoming a Sith Lord, and then when he had him emotionally, he made him kill everyone that he could. And then he took advantage of the fact that Obi-Wan cut his arms and legs off, and that's when he made him become Darth Vader. He basically built a prison around Anakin Skywalker.
Jay, you're not using enough of the lingo. You got to throw in some of those words that Steve just used.
Like polaritonic, Jay. Come on.
Polaritonic. It was a, it you put was a polaritonic a, field around
it. It was a mesotropic dual transmission protobiotic suit that they put around him.
That's better.
Right. I love it. I love it.
All right. All right, Bob.
Kara goes, I love it.
Bob. All right, you want nerdy, Kara. Bob's going to tell us about yet another paper trying to squeeze another paper out of the Drake equation.
Yeah, or, you know, kind of related to Drake, but I shall mention that. So we have another prediction about how much life there is in the universe. This time, it's couched in terms of active alien civilizations in our Milky Way galaxy right now. Researchers claim that there's likely to be at least, wait for it, 36. Anticlimactic, right? A little bit.
Wait.
36 active.
That seems like a lot for just our galaxy.
Active, oh, yeah. Okay.
Let's see. There's the Klingons, the Romulans. There's the Cardassians.
The Vorlons.
Yeah.
There's a lot of them.
Romanians.
So how confident is this assessment? And what about the Drake equation? This comes from scientists at the University of Nottingham. And it's published in a paper recently in the Astrophysical Journal. So this whole talk likely brings to mind the famous Drake equation, as Steve mentioned. This was proposed by radio astronomer Frank Drake in 1961. You know, since we don't know if there's life out there, we never got a positive hit in our searches. We don't know for sure. So you have to infer it to try to wrap your mind around it. And that's kind of what the Drake equation does. It infers the number of planets that could host a technological civilization that we could detect. And it brings to my mind anyway, Sheldon from the Big Bang Theory, who gave one of the most succinct description of the Frank equation that I've ever heard.
The Drake equation.
Now, Steve,
Frank.
He said, the one that estimates the odds of making contact with extraterrestrials by calculating the product of an increasingly restrictive series of fractional values, such as those stars with planets and those planets likely to develop life. And then he says the actual equation, N equals R times FP times NE times FL times FI times FC times L. So that was, I just remember that from years ago. It was just such a pithy way to describe it. The problem, of course, is that.
That's so pithy.
It is. It's just like it encapsulates it beautifully. So the problem, of course, is that scientists don't know precisely what those numbers are. You know, how many planets, you know, are there in the universe or in the galaxy that can host life, and then that could host life similar enough to Earth life that can develop a technology that we are familiar with, all that stuff. How do you really wrap your head around those numbers? Very difficult. We don't know what those numbers are. And of course, we've been refining them. We have a much better idea now that we've discovered all of these exoplanets, but we're not anywhere near a decent confidence levels, and we probably never will be. It's fun speculation, but I don't think it's really we're ever going to get an answer. So this is kind of what these people are trying to do. So Dr. Tom Westby, first author of this latest study, said that our new study simplifies these assumptions. You know, he's comparing it to the Drake equation. Simplifies these assumptions using new data, giving us a solid estimate of the number of civilizations in our galaxy. A solid estimate is how he describes it. Interesting. So this new research from these physics and astronomy scientists takes more of an evolutionary approach to determining how many times SETI, CETI, or communicating extraterrestrial intelligent civilizations arise. So to do that, they need to make assumptions, right? Because we just know so little. You've got to make some assumptions. And studies like these are usually all about the assumptions. So their paper starts with a general assumption, the big general assumption. And that is, if you take an Earth-like planet at an Earth-like distance from its star, and you also take a sun-like star, and you put them in a bag and shake them for 5 billion years, then it's likely that life will form, right? Without the bag, of course. I just threw that in there. So it's very likely that life will form if you replicate some of the big picture descriptions of our system. So that's a big assumption. It doesn't sound like a crazy assumption, but there it is. But then they come up with ranges of predictions, because the 36 that you see in these news items, that's just one of many different numbers that they could have said. There's lots of different ways to look at this. So they come up with ranges of predictions based on whether they apply a strong or a weak assumption on top of that original assumption, right? So you got the original assumption, and then they have another assumption that they can lay on top that's either strong or weak. And from there, you get different numbers depending on if you put the weak or the strong assumption. So the number 36 came after applying the strong assumption on top of that original one that they call the astrobiological Copernican strong condition. Now, that means that a planet-star combination similar to the Earth and Sun must not will likely create life, but must create intelligent life between 4.5 and 5 billion years. That's the overarching major assumption that they're making here. And then they add another little assumption on top of that, that the resulting civilization should be actively communicating for 100 years, just like us, right? A lot of this is based on the only data point that we have, life on Earth. So they're throwing everything that we know about life on Earth, this one data point that we have, and they're generalizing it to the entire galaxy or universe. So that's the scenario, because once you take all those assumptions that I mentioned, that life probably started on an analog to the Earth Sun, and the other assumption was that it must have created intelligent life, not likely, but must have, between 4.5 and 5 billion years, and then you have 100 years of a resulting civilization where they can communicate using technology. You add all that together, and it spits out a number, 36, or a range of numbers.
Why just 100 years?
Because that's right. I don't know.
Are they saying at least 100 years?
It says 100. It says 100. But
we've had 100 years
that's
of radio transmission?
Because at the very least, we're going to have, if we destroy ourselves tomorrow, we had at least 100 years of communication like that. So that's what they're doing. They're modeling this after what we know, which I think is, you know, how do you generalize from this one thing? So that's where 36 came from. But the 36 was actually a huge range. And 36 was just the slightly more likely than some of the other numbers. So if they applied the weak assumption to their general assumption, the answer would have been something like 928 civilizations existing right now instead of 36. Okay, now the huge problem here is that the assumptions create these huge uncertainties. They're so large that their answers could reasonably range from zero all the way to 2,908 existing right now in our galaxy, depending on which strong or weak assumption you layered on top. You know, so that remind all I could say about that. I mean, that's just wait. All right, let me just calm down a second. So it's those uncertainties. It's the huge size of these uncertainties that I think kills this entire idea, and makes these numbers. I mean, if a reasonable answer to your query is zero, then I mean, you know, how useful is this equation? You know,
it's a little like garbage in, garbage out. Like, right. It's not that it's garbage. It's just such speculation that you're putting in that, of course, that's going to magnify the speculation getting out of the,
right.
of the algorithm.
And making it kind of worthless. I tried to think of an analogy. So one I came up with, it reminds me of Darwin trying to infer the theory of evolution from one finch. Like, okay, here we go. I got a finch. And trying to come up with a theory of evolution. You're not going to do it. That's one data point. Speculating can be a lot of fun. We speculate all the time. But coming up with anything that can be characterized as a solid estimate, the way they described it, I think is just pure folly. And I'm curious to see what some other scientists say, you know, people.
Yeah, it's a pure guess.
It's a pure guess. And the way that, you know, they didn't even really throw out. I mean, if you read their paper, sure, all these details are in there. But a lot of these, and they actually do an interesting job of trying to think about all the various scenarios and you know, and metallicities of stars and all these different characteristics. So it's interesting in a way if you can get through the paper, and it's not as difficult as many other papers I've read. But I mean, this is, you know, it's fairly technical. But a lot of these news items that these science outlets are talking, you know, they put the headline out there. You know, there's 36 civilizations, alien civilizations in the Milky Way, and they really are not doing it justice and really letting you know all the assumptions and huge uncertainties that are involved. And so yet again, we're seeing more science news where the title really sucks, and they really just don't go into the detail that they should.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Again, it's kind of like it's at best a fun thought experiment at parties. You know what I mean? Like that's about the level that it is. It doesn't change anything. It doesn't really inform anything.
Because, yeah, it doesn't advance the ball.
The estimates could be zero, could be thousands. You know?
Right. And even if there are 36 alien civilizations throughout the Milky Way, they estimate that they'd be on average 17,000 light years away, and probably would be a planet, you know, orbiting a dim star that would be very, you know, next to impossible for us to even find. So even then, even in a you know, a best case scenario, almost, it's kind of like, oh shit, we, you know, even though there might be 36, we probably couldn't communicate with them anyway, based on what they were saying. But yeah, it was interesting
to research for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if civilizations on average survive for 100,000 years, then it could be 36,000 civilizations.
Well, that's just it. That's just it. And they mention that the longer, you know, if we find somehow, if we can determine that some of these civilizations can last for many thousands, like for millennia, then that would bode well for us. Or if this theory shows to us that, for example, that there's only, you know, one or two of these civilizations in the entire galaxy, that would mean that they don't last. They don't last that
well,
long.
Not maybe even there is not some necessarily, because again, not necessarily because of the other assumptions. Because maybe most planets that are like Earth, you know, and with the Earth-Sun combination, maybe most of them don't produce intelligent species. You know, maybe intelligent technological type of species are more rare than our one data point might suggest.
Exactly. You know? And
also maybe we know there's a different kind of Goldilocks zone. So it's weird that they're using this like rando Earth type planet close to the sun when most astrobiologists have moved on, especially in our solar system, to looking at things that are much farther away that use tidal energy.
Exactly.
Example.
There could be thriving civilizations underneath miles of ice on more planets than life that we, you know, carbon-based life on the Earth, right? It could be things that we would, you know, never detect. And those are the things, those are part of those are the things that are lost in all of their assumptions that could be, you know, be the cause of so much life in the universe that we'll never find with equations like this.
Yeah, and they could affect the outcome of the equation by like orders of magnitude.
Right. Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
I like that one of the variables of the Drake equation is the civilization has to survive itself. It can't it can't blow itself up in the whole process, or you have to account
that some
actually
of them exist.
Might do
yeah.
that, right? You get to the point of nuclear weapons, they may destroy themselves.
Right, or some,
or just like one bad disease.
Right, or some, or true, or some asteroid hitting the planet, or some you know, antimatter, nanotech, fusion generated type of weirdness that destroys civilizations.
Yeah, too many twistronics.
The great filter.
They could just get eaten by another organism. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of ways that
robots
always
species
can die early on.
Yeah,
or yeah,
synthetic
the robots.
Life using their artificial neural networks.
All right, thanks, Bob. Kara, tell us about this study on editing human embryos. How's that going?
Right. So one thing that's important to point out at the very beginning is that this is not the first time that researchers have been doing CRISPR experiments with human embryos. And it probably won't be the last, but this specific research team at the Francis Crick Institute, led by Kathy Nyakam, did do something a little bit different this time, and doing that little bit different thing resulted in, let's just say, a not great outcome. So it's a little bit of a harbinger. Here's a quote from a person who is not involved in the study, but a professor of molecular and cell bio at UC Berkeley. He said, "There's no sugarcoating this. This is a restraining order for all genome editors to stay the living daylights away from embryo editing." Well, that's strong language. So let's talk about what happened. All right. So there have been, like I said, previous studies where researchers have looked at embryos that are donated. So usually these are from, you know, in vitro fertilization, and then they're unused embryos. They're donated for research, and there are really strict laws around how to do this. They're usually destroyed, I think, just with after 14 days. So they don't really get to develop except for a little while beyond the genomic editing. This study, by the way, a little bit of a caveat, has not been peer-reviewed yet. So this was published on the BioArchive, which means it's basically when somebody has a finding that they think is important enough that they want the other research community to look at it. They'll publish there, and then it'll go through the peer review process, because that's obviously a very slow process. Now, usually journalists shouldn't really be reporting on things that haven't gone through peer review, but in certain instances, it's deemed kind of necessary, especially when the results are sort of like red flag results. So yes, they may pan out, they may not, but what we're talking about here is putting on the brakes, not accelerating. And so for that reason, it's actually important that these results are made more widely available. So long story short, and this part is kind of like not as important, but the researchers were looking at a pluripotency factor called OCT4. So that's like a protein that is going to help these cells divide. And it's encoded by what I want to call the POUF1 gene. I'm sure that's not how you pronounce it. It's actually POU5F1, but when you look at it, it looks like POUF1. For the purposes of this study, or this story, I'm going to call it the POUF1 gene. So what they were looking at is this POUF1 gene, which encodes for this pluripotency factor, OCT4. And what they wanted to do is manipulate it. They took a sample of these embryos, and then they submitted most of them to this gene editing at this specific locus. And they left the other ones as a control. And so then they decided, okay, now we're going to look and see what happened. And that's what most experiments prior to this have done, right? I'm going to do some sort of knockout or some sort of deletion or some sort of change using CRISPR. I'm going to do gene edit. And then I'm going to look at the gene and see what happened to it. But they said we want to go one step farther. And instead of just looking at what happens to the gene that we're specifically targeting and manipulating, we want to see if anything happens to the rest of the genome, which is actually really hard to do. They had to develop a whole protocol for doing that, like an actual procedure. And that procedure is based on something called a loss of heterozygosity. I don't know if you guys have heard of a loss of heterozygosity, an LOH, if you come across that when you're reading these kinds of articles. What that is it's actually common in nature, but they were inducing it. It also has a wide involvement in cancer. But it's basically the fact, let's do like a quick background. We know the way that, how should we do this? Okay. Have you ever seen a karyotype?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you have. Anybody else?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, yeah. So imagine a karyotype. If you've never seen one, you might want to Google one. And you'll see that, like, the human karyotype, for example, it has how many? 23 chromosomes. 1 through 22 are somatic chromosomes. And, of course, the 23rd is the XY or XX or some combination or variation based on what happened during meiosis. And so those chromosomes are rolled up DNA packaged with a bunch of proteins. And within those chromosomes, there are tons of different genes, right? So the genes are at a specific locus on the chromosome. That's the site of where the gene is.
Locus.
Does that make
is
sense?
A location.
Yeah, like L-O-C-U-S, a gene locus, or you'll hear loci when you're referring to more than one. Oh. So that's on the chromosome. It's a specific point on the chromosome where there's a gene. And all a gene is just a coding region. It's just something that codes for something on your DNA.
A protein.
Right, yeah. Usually it's going to code for a protein. Sometimes it'll be another nucleic acid or something. And so when we talk about alleles, right? We often talk about pairs of alleles, and that's because you have two chromosomes. You're one from mom, one from dad. And so you can either be homozygotic or heterozygotic, meaning you can either have two of the same allele or two different alleles. Mm-hmm. Remember back to your biology class Punnett squares with the big R and the little R and Mendel and Peapods and all that good stuff.
Yeah.
So usually you're going to be heterozygous, not always, but usually. loss of heterozygosity means that they're able to look specifically for events where one of those things got knocked out and now there's only one thing, which forces homozygosity. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. The two alleles are no longer two, it's only one, so you have a loss of heterozygosity. So those are the specific events that these researchers were looking for. And remember, they were snipping out the POOF1 gene and in 25 embryos. I found my numbers. They snipped it out in 18 of them. The other, what is that, 7 were left as controls. And then instead of just looking at that gene locus, they decided to analyze the entire genome of every embryo. Because historically, studies have shown that there are problems even at the site of the gene. Okay, so you're trying to knock it out, but maybe in some you end up gaining a little piece of DNA or a piece of the gene. Maybe in some you knock it out, but you also knocked out some of the regions near it. Well, that could be bad if something near the gene codes for something super important, right? So that's a problem. But these researchers said we need to know if it's even more of a problem than that. So they looked at the entire genome of all the different embryos, and they found out, ooh, not looking good. So 10 of them were normal. Okay, so 10 out of 25, or I guess 10 out of 18, because we're only looking at the experimental ones. That's good, but it's just over half. But they found that 8 had abnormalities on chromosome 6. And 4 had either deletions or additions to DNA that was not the edited gene. It was next to the edited gene. So we're calling these off-target effects. And we've known for a while, right, that these off-target effects can be problematic. But here they're finding that they're happening on whole chromosomes, which is really, really, really worrisome. And of course, this isn't happening in a vacuum, because we all remember we talked about it in a live show in DC, I think, when that researcher He Jiankui, remember the Chinese researcher?
Yes.
He just went rogue.
Yes, CRISPR.
Yeah, he went rogue and he decided to edit some babies to edit some embryos. And
haven't heard much from him lately.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah. And of course, this was not only totally in violation of kind of the ethics, the well-established ethics of the entire field. It was also not even a necessary thing. He wasn't trying to save a life. He was trying to prevent these kids from getting HIV, but there are perfectly good drugs that do that. So, of course, there was international outcry, a lot of changes to policy based on that. But the interesting thing that I didn't realize until I read some of the coverage of this news article is that in the U.S., if you were to implant a gene-edited embryo into a woman, you would go to jail. Like, it's illegal. Over 2 dozen other countries also have either laws or certifications or whatever that prohibit this. But a lot of countries don't have those kinds of laws. And for example, there's a guy in Russia who has published multiple times that he absolutely has plans to do germline gene editing because he wants to cure deafness, which of course didn't just get outcries from the research community, but also from the deaf community, because there are a lot of issues around the idea that deafness is a disability because it's got so much culture that's steeped into it. So this is not, you know, sort of an esoteric conversation that we're having. The truth of the matter is, although we have the technology to do germline edits, it's not perfect technology. And there's a really decent looking chance. Each new study shows us that there's a decent looking chance that we would not necessarily be producing children that were otherwise healthy if we did these kinds of edits. One more quote from another researcher who was not involved in the study. Nobody has any business using genome editing to try to make modifications in the germline. We're nowhere close to having the scientific ability to do this in a safe way. And so this is sort of like a real kind of warning. And of course, there are organizations around the world that are working on developing international standards, because this is, you know, often we talk about how technology moves faster than regulation. And this is one of those situations where we really need these regulations in place, because one rogue actor can do something that's potentially really unethical. And we're talking power of life and death here. We're not just talking, you know, interesting science experiment in the lab. So that's really important to remember.
Yeah. So we got to move carefully because the technology is not there yet in terms of safety.
Right. It doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing the kinds of experiments that this researcher are doing at the France. I mean, this is how we know, right? But yeah. There are strict protocols. Like you do the research on these embryos and at 14 days, the embryos are disposed of. So they never develop into children. And they're happening in petri dishes. They're not happening in a womb. Like they never would live on their own. And so, you know, they're doing it just for added safety and probably because of pressure, international pressure. There are a lot of like religious, cultural values, pressures to not let these embryos divide, you know, so many times that they start to resemble a fetus. So of course there are, you know, there are rules in place. The kind of research that's being done is very, very important, but to actually use this as some sort of medical technology at this point, not only is it way too soon, but it's really troubling. I don't think that the tools that we have right now, even though they're a game changer and they're amazing, it seems like they're not sufficient without some additional technological improvements.
Mm-hmm. They call that not ready for prime time.
Exactly.
All right. Thank you, Kara. Jay.
Yeah.
Who's that noisy time?
Noisy.
It's a noisy day. Last week, I played this noisy. It's funny that people always email me and mention the background noises.
That's all we could recognize, the birds.
Yeah. Like, but the typical email would be like, well, I can hear birds in the background. It's like, yeah, that's not the noisy. Okay, don't even get started. All right, here we go. The first guest was sent in by a listener named Kevin Malfa. And he says, hey, Jay, this week's noisy is so subtle, but I'll take a guess. Was this a pool vacuum pump? Why is my guess pool related? I don't know. Probably because I need to replace mine. All right. So anyway.
Wow.
It's not a pool pump. I don't even know why, Kevin, why you picked a pool pump. I've heard pool pumps. They do make a kind of whiny noise like that, I guess. But that one is incorrect. Jim Kelly wrote in, hey, Jay, I think this week's noisy is a crystal singing bowl being played outdoors. Jim, many people guessed this. You were the first. It does kind of sound like that. I don't disagree. If you listen to these crystal singing bowls, they kind of have like that monotone, you know, type of thing going on. But that is not what it is. Visto tutti, my Australian Roman god. Now this guy. Anyway, he says, that bird I have heard before. It is a European LBB. That stands for little brown bird, which means I can't identify it. The tone with low frequency modulation brings to mind a time when I was beside an oil pipeline out in the Donga. With a quiet environment, one can hear the oil being pumped through the pipes. A Donga is like a little living abode that is, you know, like a tent or a hut or a, you know, a squat shack, that type of deal. That is not correct, but interesting.
Jay, by the way.
Yeah.
You know what we call LBBs in the U.S.? And this is true.
What?
They're called LBJs.
Little brown jays?
Little brown job.
Oh, okay.
It's basically an unidentifiable brown bird, probably a sparrow. You know, it's like, but there's so many little brown birds, but they're just because of LBJ, we call them LBJs.
That's cool.
LBJs.
Brandy Hernandez wrote in. She said, 100% the Golden Gate Bridge on a recent windy day, and she happens to be the winner. She's right. So, this is what she wrote. They are new sidewalk railing slats just installed, which they did. They just updated the bridge and added some styles to it. KQED wrote an article, and turns out the bridge is now a giant kazoo. Good thing it's never windy on the Golden Gate Bridge. Just kidding. It's windy all the time. So, yeah, they added some things to it, I think, to make it a little more aerodynamic. And they hum now. And it's new. It's a new feature. So this is really cool.
Is it a feature or is it a bug?
I mean, you know, I don't have to deal with it. So, you know what I mean?
But what's with the bird getting in there audio bombing this noise?
Oh, I know. The birds are going crazy with the noise all the time, Ev. So I'd like to thank Aaron Carlson for sending that noisy and very cool noisy. I have a new noisy this week. This was a noisy sent in from a listener named Dan Whitaker. So if you think you know what this week's noisy is, or if you heard something cool, you can email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Now, Steve, every week for the last couple of months, I've been telling people about a thing that's going to happen online. It's called Nexus. And I'm telling you, there's a few things going on that people really won't appreciate until they see it. And I'm telling you to trust me, the game show night on Friday night is going to be awesome. It's going to be awesome. Steve, me, George, and Brian Wecht just had our incredibly detailed meeting and everything with Ian. And we got like just some amazing stuff coming for that game show. It's going to be a lot of fun. So I'm telling you, if you like game shows and you like to have, you know, you want to laugh, you're going to want to come to this. That night, we got Bill Nye, Leanne Lord, and Andrea Jones-Roy as contestants. And me, Steve, George, and Brian are going to be the game masters. Kara is trying to arrange her schedule where she could be one. She's going to be in...
Oh, yeah.
Where are you going to be, Kara?
Overseas. I might be in Scotland. Trying to work that out right now.
Yeah, so as soon as Kara figures out where she's going to be and if we can pull it off, because timing is actually important here, and I don't know if that's going to have an impact. We'll have to test it out, Kara.
We have to see what the delay is, and also if I really want to be awake at like 4 in the morning.
Yeah, that's
but
the
But I love
thing.
You guys,
yeah.
So I will be.
But it's going to be two days in a row then, Kara, and I want you to just be honest with yourself.
Yeah. I'll take the late or the early stuff.
But I really want you. So anyway, it's going to be a lot of fun. And then all day, the next day, which is August 1st, we are going to have a full day of conferences from 10 a.m. to probably past 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. We have a ton of people on the website that you can go see. We have Richard Wiseman.
A new addition to the lineup is my very good friend, Dr. Shane Campbell Statton from UCLA. And he is also the host, or I think the co-host, of a podcast called The Biology of Superheroes.
Yeah, that should be cool. Mm-hmm.
That's right up my alley.
Yeah.
So I'm very excited. It's a lot of fun. Please do join us. You not only will be supporting skepticism in general, but you'll also be helping us prepare for next year's conference, which will be in Atlantic City. And anything that you spend on your tickets this year will be credited to you for your tickets next year. So please do join us. If you don't mind, go to next. You know, it is a damn good deal.
Yeah.
For a day and a half of programming.
Yeah, it's basically free if you're going to both.
It's free, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So go to necss.org, and we will see you online July 31st and August 1st of this year.
Thanks, brother. All right. I think we're only going to have time for one email this week. We had numerous questions on this study, which is why I think we need to break it down a little bit. So this has to do with statistics on police use of force and police killings. I think, unfortunately, like one slice of the study is being often discussed without putting it in the full context of the whole study, which is what I wanted to do. So this was actually a Harvard professor, an economics professor who used like an economics model and also did a lot of data collection, you know, for this study, focusing on different cities around the United States. So it's not using federal level data. And it's important to note that, you know, the one thing that researchers all agree on is we don't have enough data. We need better tracking systems for all police use of force, as well as police shootings and you know, people who die at the hands of police, so that we can do good statistical analysis. But this is a big study, and the people who did the study were actually a little bit surprised by the results, which I always find is a good thing. It means that they were looking at the data and not, you know, when it goes against their preconceived notions, it's harder to think that, you know, they were working backwards from their conclusion, you know. So in any case, the thing that's been widely reported and what we got most of the questions on was that the study, if you look just at people who are killed by police officers during the time of the study in the United States, and then you look at all the different factors that might that correlate with that, they were unable to show that the race of the victim, the person who was killed, is an independent variable. In other words, you know, in this data set, cops were not killing black people at a higher rate than white people once you control for a lot of other things, such as the number of times people are interacting with the police, the crime rate, all those things. So that's what people are saying. Like, therefore, is it not true then that there isn't evidence of systemic racism in policing? That conclusion goes way beyond that one slice of data. And it's interesting that if you just look, read through the study, there's lots of other things that it reports on that show very clearly that there is systematic racism in policing. So the same data, for example, showed a very robust signal that the use of non-lethal force is consistently higher against Black Americans than not Black Americans, white Americans, for example.
And also, Steve, that's just reported uses.
Yeah, so that's,
of course, remember that too.
One of the caveats in the data. Yeah, this is like the data is not, although these researchers did go to great length to scour these reports, but yes, there's no system of systematically reporting such things. And so,
yeah, the thing is, if it was never reported, then
yeah,
you're
right,
never going to
it's
have
missing
that
from the data. But even in the data that we have, it's like across the board for every kind of use of non-lethal force, such as, you know, handcuffing, tasing, you know, just physically touching, pushing to the ground, all those things, they were higher across the cities in the study for Black Americans than white Americans. So, and that was an independent variable that could not be explained by all the other variables that they looked at. It was looked like a completely independent variable. But here's the other thing. There was much more data. There were many, many more instances of use of non-lethal force than the use of lethal force. Also, you could break the use of lethal force down into two categories, looking at instances where the person killed was armed, so like the police were shooting an armed suspect, and you could break out just situations where the person was unarmed. Now, that's a smaller group, right?
Oh, is it? Interesting. That's
smaller. Oh, it's much smaller. Yeah. Most
because
of the
shooting. It's also a massive mistake, like, or I don't know if you want to call it a mistake, but it should not happen.
It should
ever.
Never happen. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Pretty much. Pretty extraordinary circumstance. But it's relatively rare. So the absolute numbers are fairly low. It's like about, depending on the year, it could be anywhere from 500 to 1,000 people a year are killed by police. Most of those, like 700, 800, are armed suspects, and then there's a couple hundred that are unarmed. So
it's amazing, though, that we consider that a low number.
I know. It's just like crazy high when you compare it to other countries, which is another angle here. It's orders of magnitude higher than, say, the UK, for example. In that group, the researchers basically said, we can't draw any conclusions. There's just way too little data to do statistical analysis. The researchers themselves were very clear to say it's, even in the shooting, data, that even where it showed, they failed to show that there was a racial difference as an independent variable. But you always have to be careful when a study fails to show a relationship, because it could always be that it just wasn't a powerful enough study. Like, there wasn't enough data to show to statistical significance that the effect was there. And that's basically what the researcher was saying. It's not that we proved there isn't. It's just that we did in this data, we couldn't say that there was, but it's hard to know how generalizable is this data, and if it's just that a more robust data set would be able to show it. And they couldn't even make any statements about the shooting of unarmed suspects because that was way too little data statistically.
And we have to remember, too, like a couple of things. One, this is aggregate data.
Yeah.
So we know that there are pockets like Minneapolis or Minnesota as a whole, right, where we're seeing significant difference in the number.
Exactly. There's some regional differences. So for Minnesota, for example, or I think it's just Minneapolis. In Minneapolis.
Yeah, I think it's just Minneapolis.
Minneapolis, the police use of non-lethal force is 7 times higher, controlling for these other variables, meaning like number of interactions with the police, 7 times higher for African Americans than it is for Caucasians. And so that's dramatic. Yeah. So it's obviously going to vary region by region. And of course, a lot of people cite the figure that if you're Black, you're 2.5 times more likely to be killed by police than if you're white, just to take it the risk of like
Right, because they're also looking at the population.
That's just, like, that's federal level data, yeah.
Yeah, because there's 13% of the general population is black. And so if the number is the same, then that means more black people are getting killed.
Yeah, it's per capita. That's just
per capita.
Your risk, yeah. The lifetime risk for like a black male getting killed by the police is 1 in 1,000, which is not insignificant. And it's also one of the higher causes of death for young, you know, African American males.
And also just going to jail, like you see that those are really, really high. But the other thing I think that's like not left out, but that's important to remember. And again, like I'm not saying this, you could very easily, I think, get a little think I'm being conspiratorial, but I'm not. There is no incentive to be candid about force, right? Mm-hmm. So police are only going to report the minimum of what they have to report by law if they're even being scrupulous.
I totally agree. I mean, of course they are.
Just like every single time a police officer kills somebody who's unarmed, the original report almost always says it's in self-defense first, or that they saw a weapon, or that whatever. There's always reasoning that's built into the report
that
later is disproved.
Yeah, now that we're getting a lot of video evidence, the data is shifting, definitely. So
we have to remember that, too. Like, the data is probably charitable at best.
So, but even if we take it at face value, so let's just do this.
Sure.
Let's be charitable and say, all right, this data is accurate for what it is, and even given all the caveats, let's just say, let's just assume it, take it at face value. What would that mean about policing in the United States? So first of all, it does not mean, in my opinion, it does not mean that there isn't an issue of systematic racism in policing. Because again, the evidence from the non-lethal use of force is the most clear and clearly shows that there's a racial bias as an independent variable. And it also doesn't capture a lot of things that wouldn't necessarily be considered use of force, just like pulling somebody over who's driving while black, things like that. You know,
there are so many studies of these things that show over and over that blacks are significantly more likely to get pulled over.
Stop and frisk.
Blacks stop and frisk, have their cars searched, have to, you know, to just get handcuffed and then released. Like, there are a lot of studies on traffic stops and things like that.
But also, like, I think there's a lot of the emails that we've been getting indicate that I think that there's a misunderstanding by what we mean by systematic racism. That doesn't mean that every cop is racist, and in fact,
it
specifically
means
that that's not the case. Yeah, it just means that there are factors at work that make the experience of, you know, black Americans with police different, systematically different, you know, than white. Yeah. You know, in a bad way. Yeah. Than white Americans. And it could be partly just socioeconomic, you know, historical factors coming to play, under policing and over policing in different neighborhoods, the neighborhoods themselves, the effects of redlining over decades, things like that. And so all of that comes into play. There's all the societal disparities. But the problem is that policing seems to be magnifying those societal disparities. And when in fact, if anything, it should be doing the opposite. It should be seeking to mitigate or minimize them.
Right. I think I saw a really good tweet that somebody wrote, or I can't remember, social media post that said, and I'm paraphrasing, but something along the lines of like, institutional racism doesn't mean that everybody in the institution is racist. That means that even if there were no racist people in the institution, it would still negatively harm black people.
Yeah, right. It's just that the
like
way
that's
things are
the
done.
Point.
Yeah, absolutely.
The system itself has racist shit built into it. Exactly.
I think the other big issue here is just the use of force by American police compared to our industrialized nation, you know, colleagues, is orders of magnitude greater. And we need to figure out why that is, how much of that is just, again, the culture of policing, how much of it is the gun culture that we have in our country, always raising the stakes. How much of it is how, you know, policing is organized and structured and what's required of them. So
the militarization of the police forces, I think there's a lot of argumentation around that being, you know, a huge problem.
Is absolutely.
That if, you know, if you've got a hammer, everything's going to be a nail. Well, if you've got like tanks and automatic weapons,
you might need
to find an excuse to use them.
Yeah, there's two factors I think that are playing into that. One is that as in areas where social problems get out of control, like we've had an opiate problem, drug abuse problem, we're not really taking care of the mentally ill. We've deinstitutionalized a lot of mentally ill. That increases the societal demands on a city, a county, whatever, a state. And a lot of that falls to the police. And so they are then being stretched thin and being the sort of the first line dealing with things like mental illness. And that creates this revolving door approach. And this is something that we've talked about or has been talked about for decades, literally.
Everything that falls through the cracks falls on their shoulders.
And I've seen this personally as a physician. I've had patients who are caught in this cycle. You're mentally ill. You create a disturbance or you threaten somebody or an incident. The police respond. What can they do? The only thing they really can do is arrest you. So they do. You go to prison, right? Mm-hmm. And then when you're done with prison, you go to a hospital and they treat you temporarily, but then they have no place to send you. So then you go back out on the street until you commit another offense and then you get arrested again. And that's
once you've been arrested, you're completely disincentivized from entering society. You would think that everything is rehabilitative, but it's actually a massive block to reentering society. You can't get funding. You can't get housing. You can't get, you can't get educational loans. You can't get a good job, especially if you're a felon. And unfortunately, our drug laws, which have been historically also very racist, they breed felons, mm-hmm. nonviolent felons.
Yep. So you end up with like the problem of mental illness being dealt with in the criminal, legal system with police sort of on the front lines. And then you have combined with that, again, this militarization of police, which has been shown to increase the use of force by police. There are studies which show that. And so anyway, we have to, there's a lot of recommendations about what we can do to improve the situation. So I just made a list of the most common ones that I've been seeing out there. Ban chokeholds, ban no-knock warrants, rebalance qualified immunity, which means, right now police are almost immune from being sued for abuse of their, their power, their authority. A national registry of police offenders, so they can't just go to the next department, emphasize de-escalation in police training, police use of force as a last resort. Police must report every time they draw their weapon or point a weapon at a civilian. Mandated use of body cameras. Better data collection across the board for all forms of police use of force. So you'll notice that none of those have anything to do directly with race, right? This is all just about de-escalating and reducing police use of force. And of course, if we could get it down to levels that are comparable to like other similar countries, or just to, just to much lower levels, that will reduce in absolute numbers any use of force against, historically oppressed populations, and magnifying any implicit racial biases that are in the system, et cetera, et cetera. So it's all good. But in addition, there are some specifically race-focused recommendations like, you probably should make an effort so that the police force reflects the demographics of the community it's policing. It's probably a good thing.
Yeah, but there's also good research to show that that's not, it's not enough.
It's not enough, absolutely. Yeah. There's no single panacea. But we definitely have to get away from, listen, we're not trying to say that individual police officers are bad people or they're any different than the population in general. It's just people in that situation. And it's, we do need to think about how they're being structured, how they're being trained, what kind of resources that they have. And I think we really, really, really need to emphasize how to minimize excessive use of force by our police.
Right.
Systemically.
Like incentivization structures, code of silence issues, things like that, which have historically been really, really problematic. This idea that when something bad happens with the police, you saw it in the video of the old man who was knocked down and another cop was like, he reach for him, and the other cop pulled him away. And you also saw it in George Floyd's video when the cop had his knee on his neck and the other cop was like, should we roll him over? And he was like, no. It's this culture of silence, complicity, right? These kinds of things have to change. And unfortunately, sometimes this is why I think you're seeing a lot of the protesters talking about defunding the police. It doesn't mean disband the police. It means take some of the money that we're putting towards police efforts and put them into social systems, which is what we've or social programs.
Just completely restructured. So I was very interested in the Camden, New Jersey experience. Mm-hmm. which was done under a Republican governor. And it was just they basically dissolved the police and then reconstituted them in order to restructure them from the ground up. And they focused on community-based policing. And the crime rate plummeted. So that's the thing. It's not just that we're reducing police use of force, or, you know, it's just, it's also, it's actually better for the community. There's lower crime. So this idea of, like, what do you want?
Absolutely.
You know, like, you need to have aggressive militarized police in order to reduce crime. No, it's the opposite. It actually worsens the situation.
Yeah, that exacerbates it. Yeah, it instigates it. It makes people more twitchy. It makes people more afraid to actually call the police.
Right.
Obviously, there's a long history of distrust for good reason.
They're looking at it as almost like a paramilitary organization.
Oh,
it's
absolutely.
It's not a good way of looking at that. I mean, bad.
I would like to get beyond this sort of confrontational either or thing. You either support the police or you don't or whatever. No, it's that we want everyone to be functioning better. We want to make lives better for the police and for all the citizens. And of course, we want to, you know, minimize and eradicate any inequities in the system, you know, racism, sexism, whatever. We can do all of that. We can accomplish all of that. This is a situation, again, to be positive, it seems like we're at a moment, at least, where there's, you know, bipartisan support for a lot of specific fixes.
Like
we actually know what to do. We actually know what to do now. It's not like we're not sure what to do about it. Like so I'm hoping that we'll see some. So, and, you know, there are things winding their way through Congress. So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
That would be great.
But I just want to emphasize one big misconception that just to drive this point home. Saying that there is systemic racism in policing doesn't mean we have to read the mind of one cop and say that they had racial animus or intent in a specific act that they did. That's not what we mean. That's not what we're talking about. We're just talking about all of these complex factors conspire together to make the experience, you know, much worse for that segment of our population. And it grinds people down in such a way that it's horrible, and it needs to stop, and we could make it stop, and it needs to be a priority.
You know, there's coming in, as I always do with the doc recommendations, there's a great doc on PBS right now. The doc is called The Talk. And what it's really about is the talk, sadly, that African-American mothers have to have with their boys about how to conduct themselves when they are pulled over, inevitably.
Yeah.
Like, what do you do to not get killed? And the thing is, we are privileged that we don't have to have those kinds of conversations.
I've seen a lot of interviews with athletes among other people who have all alluded to that very thing.
Mm-hmm. And it's just really emotional, but it's also really telling about these everyday individual experiences that you're talking about, Steve, that add up to this concept that we are talking about of systemic racism and policing. So I highly recommend it because it just gives you, I think, a little bit more of that emotional connection to the problem, especially if you're somebody who's lucky enough to have never had to deal with it or think about it.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
Count our blessings and try to be more empathetic. Definitely.
All right, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. You guys might be familiar with the subject of the theme this week. The planet Earth. You guys have been to the planet Earth, haven't you?
Yes.
I live there.
Up until December 21st of 12.
All right.
I lived there until like the end of 2019. I don't know what goddamn planet we're on now.
Mirror, mirror, Earth of some sort.
All right. Just three pretty much random facts about the Earth. You ready?
Yeah. Random.
Here we go. Item number one, about 50% of the heat given off by the Earth's interior is generated from radioactive decay. Item number two, Earth is the densest planet in the solar system. And item number three, the driest place on Earth is the Atacama Desert in Chile and Peru, which receives on average 15 millimeters of rainfall per year. Who hasn't gone first in a while? Kara?
Damn it. I was so quiet, too.
Kara, go first.
Okay. 50% of the heat is radioactive decay. I mean, I don't know. Is that a thing? Like, isn't that what happens when the heavy elements break down into lighter elements and they give off stuff? Is that part of radioactive decay? I feel like that's a part of it. Earth is the this one seems not real to me. Earth is the densest planet in the solar system. So now I have to compare all the other planets. The gas giants are big, but they're light. And then the rocky things are heavy. And we're the biggest rocky thing, right? Right? Isn't that? But and so there's probably other like denser moons and stuff, but that's tricky because you're only talking about planets. And as of now, there's only 8 planets. And then the driest place on Earth is the Atacama Desert. I think I'm almost positive that that is science, but I have no idea 15 millimeters is the right amount of rainfall. I'm going to assume that that's not like a multi-parter where it was true except for this one small thing and say that that's science. So is the Earth the densest planet or is 50% of the heat given off generated from radioactive decay? No, I'll say that the radioactive decay one's the fiction, that Earth is the densest planet. And the radioactive decay one, there's like another reason that heat is given off.
Okay, yeah. Jay.
I do know that you know, the Earth is generating heat because of the friction that happens, you know, way down near the Earth's core and everything. But I do think that a good amount of heat comes from the radioactive decay. It's just whether or not it's 50%. So I will come back to that one. Earth is the densest planet in the solar system. Yeah, that one I think is true. And it's one of those things that's kind of just floating in the back of my head, you know, Kara? Like, you're like, I think that's true, and you don't know why.
I don't know. It seems right.
Yeah. The driest place on Earth, you literally could have made up a word, and I would have believed you. There's lots of super dry places on Earth. I thought that the North and South Poles were also considered to be extraordinarily dry. I'm going to say that the last one, the one about the driest place, is fiction, just because I think I have a good chance of just statistically that he just made up a place.
All right, Bob, go next.
You know, every damn one of these seems wrong. 50% of the heat, Earth's interior. Yeah, radioactive decay is definitely keeps it molten. But, I mean, my sense is that it's already molten and there's a lot of heat and the stuff that's actually causing heat by the radioactive decay is less, is a small part of that. And then there's the second one, the densest planet in the solar system. Sure. I mean, the gas giants are generally, not dense overall. I mean, Saturn could literally float if an ocean were big enough, it would literally float. It's less dense than water. But then again, most of the Earth is molten. Does that mean that it's less dense than, say, Mars that does not have such a huge molten core or mantle? Then that might make me pick Mars. But what about Venus? I don't know about the
core. Damn it, Bob.
Venus.
How do you not know this? You're supposed to know this.
I know. See, here's a situation where I know too damn much about these little stupid little things. And the driest place on Earth, the Atacama Desert. Jay's right. I mean, the driest place I've heard is like the South Pole, Antarctica, because it doesn't get hardly any precipitation throughout the course of the year. So I've heard that was the driest place. So, I mean, I can make an argument for all of these. All right. I'm going to go with 3, the Atacama Desert, only because I think I specifically remember reading years ago that the South Pole is the driest place.
Okay. Ah. And Evan.
I'll try to go.
You sounded too happy.
Steve, can you define the Earth's interior for the purposes of this?
So, in other words, not like radiating heat from the sun in the atmosphere from the sun. It's heat from within the Earth itself.
Okay.
There's a different heat cycle in terms of heat coming onto the Earth and being radiated away. This is heat from within the Earth leaving the Earth.
So I don't have to think about the layers of the Earth, the upper crust, the lower crust, the mantle, and all that stuff. I can consider all that is considered Earth's interior for this purpose.
Yeah. Below the ground.
Okay. I have a feeling this one's going to turn out to be right. Now, Earth being the densest planet, wouldn't Mercury be the densest planet because it's so close to the sun? I mean, the forces that would crush that rocky little thing into a tight wad, essentially. So Mercury, I don't know. Gosh, it's either that one or the driest place on Earth. I think Bob and Jay, I think, are pulling me into this one. I think without Bob and Jay's help, I must admit, I may have gone with Earth being the densest planet as the fiction. But I'll say Chile, Peru. That one, yeah, okay. I'll say that one's the fiction.
All right, so you all agree that the Earth is the
really
densest
happy right now.
Planet in the solar
damn
system.
Damn happy.
Is it Mercury?
Yep.
You all agree that that one is science, and that one is science.
It
that
is
science.
Okay.
Oh, it is. The Earth is the densest planet. Yeah, you guys are basically right. Yeah, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars are all, you know, roughly the same amount of density, and then the gas giants are all much less dense because they're mostly gas, with Saturn being the lightest one and actually being less dense than water, you know, 1 gram per cubic centimeter. So, yeah, Mercury, 5.427. Earth, 5.515. Venus, 5.243. And Mars is 3.933. Mars is the lightest of the four inner rocky worlds.
Really?
Yeah. So Mars is the lightest. Earth is the heaviest of those four.
Interesting.
Saturn's the lightest overall.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. There must be more physically more material on the Earth than the other four interior planets
It is the biggest, and so the gravity would condense it more.
The pressure is at the core. Yeah, that's true.
Mm. All right, so let's go back to number one. About 50% of the heat given off by the Earth's interior is generated from radioactive decay. Kara, you think this one is the fiction. The guys think this one is science. Mm. And this one is science.
Yeah!
Nice. Sounded science-y.
So it is the poles.
It is the poles, yeah, but we'll get there. So, yeah, this was based upon a study from a couple of years ago where they looked at, Bob, what do you think they were looking at?
Looking at the core of the Earth?
Anti-neutrinos.
Oh, anti-neutrinos.
Anti-neutrinos.
Who's anti-neutrinos?
They're also calling geo-neutrinos. Ever hear that term before, geo? These are anti-electron neutrinos. Yeah. But they are generated by radioactive decay in the Earth's crust, mostly uranium, some thorium, and some potassium.
I love thorium.
Potassium 40. So, yeah. From that, they were able to estimate how much of that radioactive decay is happening. And then from that, how much heat would that release? And that accounts for about half of the heat that is radiating from the Earth itself. Again, not the heat that's coming from the sun, but just from coming from inside the Earth. So that is how much would you say if you had to put it? No, it's like one of those massive figures you could never guess on your own.
Wait, what is what? What are you
How
asking?
Much energy are we talking about? How much heat energy? How much,
25 petajoules.
Yeah, like what do you even measure that in? Joules? Unit.
44 terawatts. 44 terawatts, which are joules per second, right? A watt is a joule per second. So, okay. 44 is the total, and about half of that, or 22, is coming from the radioactive decay. Now, if you recall Lord Kelvin, right?
Yes, I do remember Lord Kelvin.
Yeah, Lord Kelvin calculated.
He kind of called it.
No, he got it wrong. He calculated the age of the Earth based upon its current likely temperature and the temperature that it was when it formed. Wow. And according to him, the Earth should only be tens of thousands of years old. Because
there you go.
Right. But Steve, if you remember the history, the young whippersnapper who was talking about how radioactive decay is responsible, he was extremely diplomatic when dealing with Lord Kelvin. And he said Lord Kelvin actually kind of figured it out, because Kelvin said, unless there's a process, a nuclear process we are unaware of, the Earth's core should be solid. So he kind of was very diplomatically handed him like a peace offering while wiping away his belief system.
He gave him an out.
What was going on. Yeah, he gave him an out, and it was actually a really cool thing to do. So that's what I meant.
Yeah. But the bottom line was, if you didn't know about radioactive decay, because he didn't, because it was before radioactive decay was discovered,
right.
Then if you just calculate the temperatures, thermodynamics, it seems like the Earth should have already been solidified by now.
And the same with the sun. As you calculate it as a burning ball of gas, like there's no way it's going to last for hundreds of millions of years.
Yeah. But now we know about nuclear fusion and radioactive decay. Right. All right. All of this means that the driest place on Earth is the Atacama Desert in Chile and Peru, which receives on average 15 millimeters of rainfall per year. That is the fiction. The Atacama Desert is the second driest place on Earth.
Damn it.
It's the
driest non-polar region.
Yes, it is the driest non-polar region. A lot of sources forget to put non-polar in there, which is why it's sort of I thought it would be a good fiction.
Yeah, it's like known as the driest place on Earth. That's like its moniker.
Yeah, right. But only non-polar. What is the driest place on Earth? You have to get more specific than Antarctica. Where it is Antarctica, but where in Antarctica?
Directly at the South Pole?
No.
Interesting.
The Ross Ice Show.
The Dry Valleys.
No.
The Dry Valleys.
That's the name.
There hasn't been any rain there in 2 million years.
Well, what are they waiting for?
What? Jeez. 2 million years?
Maybe tomorrow.
There's no ice there because there's no water. There's no ice. There's no snow. Because it would have, if it had snowed in the last 2 million years, it would still be there. That's why.
Well, how did they know it wasn't more than 2 million years?
Well, I don't know. I didn't.
It hasn't rained in at least 2 million.
Yeah, maybe at least it's 2 million. But that's what they're saying. it hasn't. We know, like, for the last 2 million years, that there's been no precipitation there, to use Bob's term, and it's because of just the atmospherics there. The it's so cold. How cold is it? That any moisture in the air becomes really, really heavy and sinks down, and so it never gets to that place, that valley. It can't get over the mountain into that valley. So there's never any water there, no precipitation.
Wait, so there's no ice at all?
Yeah, it's bare ground in the middle of the Antarctica.
Weird.
Yeah.
But wow, it's like perma. Awesome. Is it like permafrost ground? Like,
no, it's a rock. You know, you look at this.
Yeah, it's
got to
be like rock.
It's rock.
Because
yeah,
it's still frozen rock, but with no ice in
there's
it.
There's no snow, no ice. Yep.
Weird.
Yeah, very cool. That's the driest place around. Zero precipitation.
But that 15 millimeters, is that
that's
right
accurate.
For the Atacama?
Yep, that's accurate.
Yeah. Okay.
Although some years it has can go a couple of years without rain, but that's why I said on average.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, good job,
I was
guys.
Almost right.
Yeah, that was tricky. I admit it was a little tricky, but, you know, it's the
So
Earth.
I was like, definitely the driest place on Earth. That's the only one I know.
I first heard about the Atacama Desert because of a bit of pseudoscience that derives from there. Are you guys familiar with this?
No.
But this is the 2-inch alien. You guys ever seen that?
Oh, I remember that.
This mummified alien from the Atacama Desert. But it's probably just an abortion, you know, that somebody discarded, you know.
It's a fetus. Yeah,
it's a fetus.
For sure.
Yeah. It's a fetus, yeah. Or it was a spontaneous abortion, either way, but it's a fetus. It's a human fetus. There's no question. Mm. But
it's not a tiny adult.
It's not a star child or something crazy.
No, not an alien. Evan, give us a quote.
Science is elegant and beautiful, but it requires an effort to understand. This is a golden opportunity to educate people. Any person with a scientific temperament, not necessarily a scientist, cannot support these types of messages. And that was said by Hassan Al-Hariri, who's the CEO of the Dubai Astronomy Group, when asked about the June 21, 2020 doomsday insanity.
Good on him.
And that's awesome. It was very well said. And I'm very happy to know that there's a Dubai Astronomy Group. Very, very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Their mission is to promote the study of astronomy and related fields in the Middle East and the region, in that region of the world. So that's really cool.
Awesome.
Love it.
Yeah, I like that quote. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Anytime you need me, man.
And we will see you on the Friday live stream.
Yeah, that's
right. SGU has been live streaming at 5 p.m. Eastern time every week.
We'll see you yesterday.
Yeah, we're going to keep doing that. For as long as we want to. So we'll see you all there. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.